WCRS 98.3 102.1. This is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton.
And I'm Bob Fitrakis, and we're here with Jerry Bello. And we're going to talk about many things, including the resurrection of anti-racist action in Columbus, Ohio, as it's been ongoing in other parts of the country. And Jerry's going to explain what anti-racist action is. But Jerry has a history here in Columbus. First came to my attention when the police accused them of rioting back in the mid-1990s.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't bring my exciting radio voice. I first met Bob when he did a piece on a protest that I participated in while I was in college that wound up with my face getting pounded into the pavement on High Street. So, actually, it wasn't as bad as the, I can't say that word, whooping that they gave, that the Columbus policemen gave me afterwards when they had me alone in the paddy wagon and tore some of my hair out for taking the Lord's name in vain in the paddy wagon. But moving right along.
Well, the Lord was Woody Hayes, you can understand. Lord, someone gets in there, bad mouth is Woody Hayes, he needs a little hair loss.
Yeah, they thought I was wearing a Michigan shirt and, decided to tear all my hair out.
I was wearing a Penn State shirt the other day. People were giving me a hard time. I didn't expect that.
Welcome to Columbus. And out of those events...
Leave your civil rights at the door.
out of those events, and I always felt that was interesting because it was a Saturday and no one was even downtown. And the police claimed they were protecting the public, which...
What public?
Wasn't there.
The public doesn't go downtown on the weekends.
It's a Saturday in Columbus, right? It's who was there that you were threatening with a lot of radical signs at the time, including don't cut student loans, as I recall.
Yeah, it was that day. I was always wondering if Representative, then Representative Kasich had a hand in it because...
he was the target.
Yeah, he was the target.
And now gubernatorial candidate John Kasich. Former Lehman Brothers manager John Kasich and Fox News commentary.
I'm really glad, and I never get tired of the fact that his name rhymes with the word sick.
Well, I actually ran against him in 1992, which is one of the reasons I was interested in the story.
You should have run him over.
Oh, we can't say that. He's a former congressman and a gubernatorial Canada. I did almost run him over, though, at an anti-NAFTA event. Physically run him over, not with a car. Just he turned around to confront me when I asked him why he was outsourcing jobs. And I think he expected me to stop. But instead, I was headed right towards his face to get up in it. And then he ran. And we had him on tape running. We were going to make a commercial. So he ran out of the downtown athletic club. And sadly, someone stole the tape. Out of our van later that day, but it was a great tape. But anyway, out of that, you hooked up with people like Jim McNamara, attorney extraordinaire in the North Campus area, and two famous groups came out of that. One being Anti-Racist Action, but another, I think, equally important group, Cop Watch.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Cop Watch in Columbus was mostly a project of Anti-Racist Action. It was its own standing organization in other cities, and I had worked with Cop Watch a little bit in Berkeley, California in the early 90s. But here it was sort of a wholly owned subsidiary of Columbus Anti-Racist Action, is like pretty much everybody that did Cop Watch work also did work with Anti-Racist Action. So it was sort of a subset of us. And I actually did very little Cop Watch work myself when I was involved, mostly because I figured if I went out on patrol with everyone else, the cops would be horribly provoked. And, you know, with my record as a convicted aggravated rioter, actually, I was never convicted of aggravated riot, but as... With my record as a convicted rioter, I might poison the jury just a little bit. So I
now, was that a misdemeanor?
It was a misdemeanor riot. I am still a citizen and enjoy all the privileges not currently enjoyed by Ohio's felons.
All right. And many other things happening in that time period. I actually went along with Cop Watch to report on them and ended up being maced myself on one occasion.
That was a great one. The 600 people on the street, random cop car pulls up, cops jump out, mace Bob, and drive off. Oh, there's Bob Petrakis. Get him, spray, and drove off.
Maced the hell out of me. And it wasn't lost on me at the time. I was writing about police corruption at the highest levels of the Columbus Police Department, including the chief.
Like, gotcha.
We always wondered exactly, why I was apparently targeted.
Maced at a 600-person anti-police brutality march. That was brilliant.
And not only that, later in the march, the guy I was writing about, Commander Markham, who I correctly, it was from public records, his brother was a crack addict who was dealing cards at a illegal gambling house. And I also wrote, and this is probably why I was maced, that his mama was working the kitchen making the sandwiches and that his sister was also playing in the game. A man had been shot there, police officer Mount Vernon Johnson. And it wasn't really the cop watched that type of activity. What we watched was the famous type of activity, like a riotous mob of 300 surrounded the police, and then the videotapes would show two cop watchers across the street being slapped around by the cops after they witnessed some brutality.
That's the wonderful thing I always loved about the Columbus police is the beating that you catch on tape is nothing compared to the beating that you catch all the way to the station, because they're cowardly and wouldn't dare fight you until you're handcuffed.
And as we used to say, they like to test a lie in court. And out of that came, as you pointed out, anti-racist action was first. Why was anti-racist action an important historical organization in Columbus, Ohio?
Well, I mean, I personally have been to probably somewhere around 400 anti-Klan or anti-Nazi events, shows, little actions, big actions over the last 17 years. And, you know, I've done it in the north and the south and the west, a little bit in the east. But hands down, at any given time, there are more Klan rallies in Ohio. If something's going on, if there's an upsurge in fascist activity, there'll be more Klan rallies in Ohio than the whole south put together, including Texas, including Arizona. I think we can pretty much put Arizona in the South now. They made the grade.
But not traditionally. They're going straight after the Hispanic population as opposed to the black. Mm-hmm. But, again, clearly showing their Southern roots. And the first book of the so-called Petrakis Files that I wrote was Spooks, Nukes, and Nazis. And if you go back and look there, there's a lot of analysis on why so much Klan neo-Nazi activity in Ohio, part of it, the nine major industrial areas, some which actually have gay communities, large minority communities, and really it's, in many ways, is it not an ideal place for the neo-Nazis and white supremacists to recruit, because you've got a lot of white people, but you've also got a bad economy, and you've got the traditional scapegoats that the white supremacists love.
Well, there's that, and there's also, I mean, the Klan and the neo-Nazis aren't as active where white supremacy is more entrenched. They're not necessary. It's a
not a whole lot of rallies in Idaho.
There's been three that I can remember. Mm-hmm. It's where old style white supremacy is being challenged generally by society is where you get these groups to react, where these groups grow because people are losing their privilege, their private law. And Ohio is the middle of the country. It's always going to be a battleground. They're always going to feel challenged here because, you can even see it in an election. Where goes Ohio, goes America.
Well, one of the things that's been argued, when the country swings, it seems when there's a Democrat in office and the right swings hard to the right with accusations, you know, Clinton being a socialist, or now you got 17% of the whole population, a third of Republicans thinking Obama's a Muslim, even though in the 08 election they thought he was a really bad Christian for worshiping under Reverend Wright. In fact, the right called him the wrong Reverend Wright, and everyone knew Obama was a Christian, but not the right type. But when it swings to the far right, doesn't it seem like that unleashes the white supremacists? You're sending them a sign like, crawl out, it's okay to be a racist again?
Well, I mean, it's not a matter of it's okay. During the Bush years, I mean, there's a lot of things came together to give us a few quieter years. I mean, on one level, the Bush administration was, you know, the right wing was having some of its needs, its emotional needs were being met, at least. And I'm, you know, the Obama presidency definitely has something to do with it, or it's at least something that a white supremacist can wave around. And the economy certainly helps them. But, I mean, in 2001 and 2002, with Bush in office and with a bad economy, and with a lot of mass questioning and uncertainty about war, there was a major, major, major fascist resurgence in this country led by the National Alliance. And anti-racist action nationally played a role in defeating that in hard, you know, mostly on the East Coast, but with actual hundreds of persons involved on both sides, pitched battles in the streets in several cities, like day-long battles. And in these, frankly, semi-military confrontations, we won and they lost, and their organizations collapsed. You know, we were dealt a lucky stroke by the death of William Pierce. That's no doubt that some, you know, probably the smartest fascist in America, picking a really good time for us to die of cancer, was a very, very helpful thing to the society, and we thank Dr. Pierce for shedding his mortal coil, and hope that he's burning in hell. But
no, he was the one that created the sea monkeys?
No.
Or what? What was his claim? No, that was the guy out in Idaho who did the sea
monkeys. Yeah, no,
right?
He was a chemist, and he made a fair piece of money off of something, but he also managed to make fascism profitable with his...
songs, with comic books, with popular books.
With owning every significant title. You know, he printed Mein Kampf. He printed the Turner Diaries. He wrote the Turner Diaries. He had two successful white supremacist novels.
So he was Andrew McDonald?
He was Andrew McDonald. He purchased every neo-Nazi record company, and at the time of his death, his compound had a full-time paid staff of 17, right? And none of them were security guards. You know, he had a major, major, major operation, and you know, the pressure brought on by his death, our victories, and their internal leadership struggles following his death collapsed them. And, you know, it's taken them a while to sort of get organizationally back together, but there are new organizations moving forward for them, you know, in times that are fertile. And we can expect quite a few years of hard work before there's any bit of quiet in the streets anymore. It's getting worse this year, and it's going to get worse next year.
But aren't messages sent from the top? For example, when Ronald Reagan runs for president, he appears in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and talks about states' rights. I mean, it's mostly known for the rise of the modern Klan and buried civil rights workers like Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney. And David Duke at the time says his speech sounded like it was written, as well as his platform, by a Klansman. I mean, when Sarah Palin shows up in small towns in Pennsylvania and says, well, it's really good to be around real Americans. I mean, isn't she sending a message to the kind of people like yourself, Mr. Bellow, and other urban polyglot cities on the East Coast where you had to battle people. Like, I mean, New York City. Isn't there a hatred of the melting pots of the urban areas of the Northeast? And don't these signals come right from the top? And isn't it also coming from the top about the Hispanics at this point?
I'm going to go ahead and disagree there. I mean, Sarah Palin, although she's bought, she doesn't represent the top. Like,
but she's the top, she's the vice presidential candidate. So she doesn't own stuff, but she's sending the political message, as is Glenn Beck, who happens to be a Mormon who are obsessed with genealogy. When you've got Ronald Reagan, he may not be in control, but he sure is the head sock puppet.
I guess one question I have is that, you know, it seems like in the mainstream, a lot of times racism is unpopular, it's not cool. But, you know, you maybe get a lot of, like, racism deniers, and it seems like they're
the Tea Party.
Still, yeah, exactly. I mean, they're probably racist elements to the Tea Party, and yet they're denying that they're racist, and it seems like that happens a lot. There's, you know, we have a pretty pretty long history of racism in the United States. I think sometimes it can be hard to see if you don't know it as such, you know. I guess what about, you know, the white supremacist groups that try to recruit people? You know, how, if people are on one hand claiming that it's unpopular, that people who are racist are ignorant, you know, it seems like their message must be a little bit more sophisticated than just overtly spewing hate. And, you know, that they're couching racism in a lot of other messages about the economy. You know, I think the xenophobia that Americans have right now against immigrants is pretty overt. But, you know, African Americans have been in the United States for a long time. It's clear that they're Americans and that they may be, you know, that they have, like, a right to be in the United States. You know, it seems like, you know, obviously we still have a lot of problems with racial tension and inequalities, yet people are willing to kind of say, like, oh, no, you know, racism isn't cool.
Right, and then right after that, it doesn't exist, but
it doesn't exist, but then people still act and speak in ways that are clearly, it seems, you know, perpetuate the racist policies.
Look at rap music. You've got hip-hop music, anti-gang violence, essentially political bottom-up. NWA goes to number one in 1989, 1990. Suddenly the large corporations buy up and get distribution deals, and suddenly it's all gangsta with an A, rap, and the vast majority of that's being sold to white suburbia. I mean, is it any different than Birth of a Nation? I mean, isn't it the same violent black icon that has been scaring and entertaining white people, and of which wealthy people have been exploiting forever?
Agree. Well, I mean, y'all threw a lot on the table there. To get back,
it's our job.
To get back to the question of Sarah Palin, and I mean, there's always a certain segment of the elite that would like to coddle and encourage fascist movements, but fascist movements, they well up and they exist on their own. They as much as you can try to bring forth a Sarah Palin or a Glenn Beck to harness or control that horse, you know, history's clearly shown, Hitler's clearly shown that horse eventually that horse rides you. You know, I mean, certainly if you...
But Hitler was financed, was he not, by the Union Banking Corp, Prescott Bush, Fritz Thyssen, the steel magnate. I mean, they were really financed, and their infrastructure was created by elites in the U.S. and Germany.
Agreed. But if those same elites were asked, do you want to go ahead with a disastrous two-front war where we take on the whole world,
right,
they'd say, certainly not. You get to a certain point where the ruling class to some degree benefits, but it doesn't rule.
Well, it's like an attack dog, right? To a certain extent, the fascist, neo-Nazi, Klan movements are like terrorist attack dogs, but sometimes they go rabid off the leash and turn on everyone.
Well, it's not sometimes. It's
inevitable.
When it's inevitable with their seizure of power is when they turn is when the I mean they still use they still these conglomerates still benefit, but they're in, once they're in charge, they're in charge. It's the leader principle, the Führer prinzip, the leader principle of fascism. But on another level, it's to say, to call fascists the ruling class attack dog is a bad analogy. You go get a puppy, you make it mean, you breed it up, and one day it bites you. These things are self-created. It's not a puppy that you got at the pound and trained. It's not something you bred. There's lots of them, and you found one, and you picked it, and you nurtured it. And there's a difference. These fascist movements, and this is going to what Connie was talking about with the fabric of society, right? These things self-create out of American soil because we've got a problem. People have enjoyed a certain amount of privilege for a long time, and when that privilege slips, they resort to the one privilege that they've got left, which is violence, right? And the question of fascism and why fascism has to be fought, not struggled against, not fought, is because fascism as a political question is inseparable from violence. Fascists cannot exist, cannot move forward, can't advance their movement. They might use the ballot box, but they're based on
It's about force.
It's about directly empowering the movement's own members. Fascism's fun if you're a fascist. It's really empowering. You get to be very involved in violently remaking society into your own assumed warrior image. And without fighting fascism and depriving it of... You can't defeat fascism unless you physically defeat it and deprive it of that narrative. It has to fight to win. And when it loses a lot more than getting a black eye or a bloody nose. It loses because it derives its moral authority from violence and only from violence. When it's defeated physically, you defeat its own source of its own moral authority over itself.
But isn't it also, as Mussolini said, corporatism? And isn't there a symbiotic relationship? And isn't it also fundamentally, as Mussolini said, anti-liberal? It exists to create an authoritarian or totalitarian society.
Absolutely. It's anti-liberal. I'll go further. It's anti-enlightenment. You know, when Hitler was made chancellor, I forget which famous Nazi proclaimed rather loudly, the year 1792 has been destroyed, right? That fascism at its core is violent, direct suppression of the Enlightenment, of rationality, and that's where we can take another look at one of the key underpinnings of American society, religion, where we have the right wing directly attacking any science, especially environmental and biological science, that doesn't fit their worldview.
Right, if it's science and making bombs and you know, that stuff, then it's probably fine, right?
Physics and chemistry are cool. Physics and chemistry, cool. Biology and environmental science, not so much.
Well, unless you're charting the human gene code and patenting it.
Patent law.
Not so much of that either. There are some things they'd rather not. I think, you know, given their druthers, they grudgingly have antibiotics as a necessary evil. But other than that, I don't think they really, really want to open Pandora's box over there. I mean, you know, there's some money to be made in it for sure, but I'm sure that they would, given their druthers, very much control genetic research to force it to prove their crackpot 19th century theories. Evolution's only useful to the right wing insofar as it proves that they should be in charge. Otherwise, they derives their proof from somewhere else.
So social Darwinism, if you can say, like, oh, well, you know, the reason that we're on top is because we're more socially fit than African-Americans, women, people with smaller brains. Women who have smaller heads and smaller brains are inferior, less intelligent.
But why join the anti-racist action now? Do we really have enough problems that people need to join? Would you say the group's militant? Is it unfair to call it? Isn't it militant anti-fascist?
Well, I don't see how you can be an effective anti-fascist without being militant. But yes, we are. And that's not some matter of posturing. I mean, frankly speaking, there's lots of things I'd rather be doing than all that screaming and jumping around and stuff. But I mean, there's a need to do this work, and
by that work you mean investigate, dare I say, reconnoiter and confront,
yeah,
actual white supremacists. I mean, that's the work you're talking about.
And by I don't like to say the phrase any means necessary, but I will say the means most expedient and, frankly speaking, least costly to the rest of the left, disrupt and ultimately dismantle their organizations. I mean, I haven't figured out how to make someone not a racist bastard, right? I mean, I've punched a lot of people, and through those actions, I have yet to make anybody smarter. But I have made them discouraged. And if I can't make them smarter, I can make them discouraged. I can keep them from getting together with their friends and going out and hurting people.
Is there some point at which, if they get too empowered or emboldened, inevitably there'll be problems? What about the militia movement with this post 500,000 men? I mean, did they become over emboldened in Oklahoma City, or what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, Oklahoma City, let's really take a look at that. The militia movement, the Michigan militia, threw Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols out because they were dangerous people. And the
McVeigh wasn't he Christian Identity or one of the white supremacist,
yes,
neo-Nazi religions?
Tim, I mean, the cell that did the Oklahoma City bombing, Nichols, McVeigh, Fortier, Michael Brescia, right, were a cell of a neo-Nazi underground that called itself the Aryan Republican Army. There was another linked cell that carried out a number of bank robberies in the Midwest.
Some of their members busted, by the way, in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
Commander Pedro.
And then a third cell of the Aryan Republican Army was the Kehoe brothers. Chevy and Cheyenne Kehoe.
Who also had a famous shootout in Ohio.
The Michigan militia, those militia groups rejected all of these people as dangerous lunatics. And the white supremacist movement, you know, although also on the right, and I'm not, you know, passing the Michigan militia halo, but the Michigan militia was not interested in going out murdering people, drowning people in swamps, and blowing up buildings. And that's what the Aryan Republican Army wanted to do and did. The white supremacist movement was definitely open to embracing them, hiding them, financing them. And these groups, in turn, financed the above-ground white supremacist movie. All the money that Commander Pedro's people stole was never recovered. That went into their movement.
At least 22 banks were robbed. We're here with Jerry Bello wrapping up with Anti-Racist Action. How can then people contact Anti-Racist Action?
You can check out our website at antiracistaction.net.
That's Jerry Bello.
This has been WCRS 98.3, 102.1, Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell-Newton.